Welcome to the Psalm Companion to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. We are in Psalm number 9 today. This is going to be yet another Psalm of David, and of course written to the choir master. We're going to need some people to sing this. We need the choir to ring this one out. And, you know, this is a... We're recording this, and this will be released not too far after Thanksgiving. And David's going to start with giving thanks, Chad. We got a little thanks to give God.
Yeah, you know, sometimes these psalms will start out with, you think they're going to be like full of just exuberant joy, and then after you get like a verse or two into them, they take this hard turn. You're like, whoa, what just happened here? You're hearing about enemies lurking and stumbling and perishing and rebuking nations. And so that is very characteristic of the Psalms. They start out, many of them start out with thanksgiving, with praise, with hallelujahs. And then having said that, they'll switch from praise to like protest or whatever's going on in their lives that they're reaching out to God in the Psalm to talk about. So yeah, David starts out the first two verses with giving thanks to the Lord with my whole heart. I will recount all of your wonderful deeds. I will be glad and exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. So good way to start. Good way to start our prayers. Good way to start any kind of conversation with God by giving thanks and recounting his wonderful deeds and psalming. I will psalm your name, literally, is what is being communicated here in the Hebrew. Sing praise, or I will zamar your name. I will psalm your name. But then verse 3 comes along and he switches. He says, when my enemies turn back, they stumble and perish before your presence. For you have maintained my just cause. You have sat on the throne giving righteous judgment. So David has plenty of enemies to worry about, but he says that these enemies will stumble and perish before the face of God, because God is the one who maintains his cause. He's the one who's seated on the throne judging righteously.
This is certainly one of the things he's thankful for, right? I mean, he's like taking a look, and his enemies are stumbling as they run away from him. And he's like, hey, thanks, God. Like, I appreciate you taking up my cause. I tell you what, I really appreciate that with my whole heart, actually, that my enemies have not reached me. In fact, in their fleeing, you pursued them. Yeah, I'm going to sing praises to your name for that, for sure.
Yeah, and then this also happens pretty frequently in the Psalms. He'll take an individual situation and he'll kind of amplify it, universalize it, because here he begins to talk about not just like his personal enemies, but the nations. You have rebuked the nations. You have made the wicked perish. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. The enemy has come to an end in everlasting ruins. Their cities, you rooted out. The very memory of them has perished. So, I mean, this is a pretty common idea of such a universal and such a deep destruction that the very memory of the people that were opposed to God's way, the very memory of them perishes, like complete obliteration. Which, I've always appreciated, because I love the idea of God taking sin and just completely annihilating it, so that it's gone. I mean, the very memory of it has perished. So, I'll take verses like this, and you kind of read them in the shadow of the cross, and you're like, oh yeah, that's exactly the way that God works.
In the Old Testament, like the idea of like some kind of eternal judgment is very much connected to the idea that nobody would remember you. Like that's the eternal judgment, is that you'd have no legacy, no one would know your name, nothing is written about you, nobody will ever remember. It's as though, like, shortly after you're perishing, it's as if you never were. And this, of course, would be like the worst of all things, right? that mm-hmm. You'd never be no memory of you on earth.
Yeah, and that's why the opposite of that is true too. When you have people wanting to make a name for themselves, or to have a name, to be remembered, then that would be the idea of being everlasting.
Yeah.
That was basically what was happening at the Tower of Babel back in Genesis. They wanted to make a name for themselves. That is to say, they wanted to build a tower which would perpetuate the memory of them. And of course,
yeah, that's the way to live forever, right?
Yes, yeah. That's the way to establish an everlasting memory by doing something like that. So then we have a contrast here between what happens to the enemies and then what happens to the Lord. The Lord, verse 7, but the Lord, he sits enthroned forever. He has established his throne for justice, and he judges the world with righteousness, and he judges the peoples with uprightness. So even though on earth the memory of these evildoers is completely gone, the Lord sits stable, enthroned forever, the one who will not pass away, the one who is judging the peoples, not unjustly, but with righteousness and with uprightness. And for the oppressed, verse 9, he's a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. And those who know your name will put their trust in you, for you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. So we kind of got three different groups going on here. We've got the divine group, I guess we could call it. We have God. He's sitting on his throne. He's established. He's looking over everything. We know that he's never going to pass away. We know that he's going to work righteousness and justice and do that which is good. Then we have the adversaries. And the adversaries, the evildoers, or the emblems of wickedness are going to be obliterated, destroyed. The very memory of them is going to perish. But then we also have the other group, and this is where David would locate himself, and that is the oppressed, people in trouble, the people who need to put their trust in God and seek him because they know that he's going to be a stronghold for them. And in knowing his name, they put their trust in him because they know that the name of the Lord is going to be with them when they're in the midst of their struggles.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very comforting verse right here, right? I mean, that the Lord does not forsake those who seek him. That's good.
Yeah, yeah. It means that he's not the kind of God who sees that you're in the midst of problems and basically says, well, I guess we'll see how this goes.
Yeah.
He's going to have to deal with that himself. He's not the kind of, not a fair weather God who is great when things are going great, but terrible when things are going terrible. He's the kind of God who especially is there in those times of need to be not a rickety old shack for you, but a stronghold, a tower, a castle that you can find refuge in. And because of that, verse 11, we have more praising. Sing praises to the Lord. He sits enthroned in Zion. Tell among the peoples his deeds, for he who avenges blood is mindful of them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted. I love the kind of dual image here, too, by the way. He's enthroned in heaven, but he's also where? He's enthroned in Zion.
Yeah.
So where's God at? Well, he's in heaven, but he's also in Zion. He's put himself there in Jerusalem. He's enthroned in the Holy of Holies. And so you know that that is where you can cry out to him. And he is going to not forget. He's going to not just hear the cry of the afflicted, but he's not going to forget it. He's going to act on their behalf.
Yeah. And I like, too, that this is a little bit like, you're like, whoa, he's a blood avenger, is he? Okay, that's a lot, which tells you a couple of things. One, that avenging is not something that you should go about doing. This is actually something that God does. And two, that as David moves into verse 13, he is going to ask God to be gracious to him so that you know that God's care for you, even if you are the oppressed, that God's avenging of the wrong done to you is still done out of grace, right? This is not God just saying, well, you deserve, I'm going to give you what you deserve and be there for you. But the fact that God is there for you and that he is going to hear the cry of the afflicted, all of this is done out of grace.
That's his motivation.
Yes.
That's why God does this. Yeah. He doesn't look down and say, wow, that guy is so righteous. I'm going to save him. He looks down through eyes of grace, and because of that, he rescues. And so David says, be gracious to me, O Lord. See my affliction from those who hate me. You who lift me up from the gates of death. And then notice how he goes from that image of the gates of death to what he says in verse 14. So you who lift me up from the gates of death, that I may recount all your praises, that in the gates of the daughter of Zion, I may rejoice in your salvation. So the gates of death is the pretty common image in the Bible. Another ancient Near Eastern literature too, where you have like there's a gate, a doorway to Sheol. But this is Matthew 16, right? The gates of Hades shall not prevail against the church. That is, they can't stand when the church attacks. The gates will fall when the church goes in. And here, so he's like, what would we say in English? He's like, he's got one foot in the grave. Is that kind of the expression we would give? So, I mean, he's like one foot. When I've got one foot in the grave, you're going to pull me back. So you're going to lift me up from the gates of death so that in the gate of the daughter of Zion, I can sing your praises. You're going to lift me from death to life, from the point of destruction to the point of exaltation.
Yeah, I love how in the Bible, like it actually doesn't seem like it makes sense when it comes to the grammar, but theologically is important. It always will refer to salvation as belonging to God, so that I may rejoice in your salvation. I'm like, well, God wasn't saved.
Yeah, wasn't it my salvation?
It's like, I think it was, you're rejoicing in your salvation. You were the one that was saved. God didn't need any saving. But no, it always says your salvation. And if it ever says my salvation, most of the time it'll say like something like, oh, God of my salvation, which still then means mm-hmm. that it's still telling you it's who owns God's the salvation. Yeah. Which is, like I said, like you might be reading it and you're like the words might hit you weird where you're like, why am I'm rejoicing in God's salvation? Like that's weird. And no, it's your salvation, but the author wants to be very clear where this salvation belongs, where this salvation came from, who it belongs to. This is the God of salvation. That's who he is.
Yeah. And he shows that in saving, but also in the same time in making sure that the one from whom you are rescued is going to also experience the judgment, which is what verse 15 and 16 talks about. The nations have sunk in the pit that they've made, in the net that they hid, their own foot has been caught. The Lord has made himself known, he has executed judgment. The wicked are snared in the work of their own hands. So, I mean, this is all over the Psalm. It's all over the Bible, actually, where the one who digs the pit to catch somebody else falls into it. The one who sets the snare to catch somebody else is caught in it. So the wicked is destroyed by their own wickedness. This is kind of Romans 1 kind of stuff, right? Like the worst thing that can happen to us is our own will being done. More or less. Yeah. God, save me from my own will, please. And let your will be done instead.
Imagine a guy that like sets a bear trap out in the woods and then like is out in the woods and comes across a bear and then is running away from the bear and steps in that trap.
Yeah. I mean, that would be a very biblical, punishment fitting the crime kind of situation. So verse 17 kind of continues the same thing. It says the wicked shall return to Sheol. I always thought that was a fascinating description.
As if that's where they came from.
Yeah, I mean, I would have expect this to say the wicked shall go or descend or whatever to Sheol, but it doesn't say that. It says all the wicked will are basically going home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Return to Sheol. So where's your home? Sheol, death. You're just going right back to where you came from. Our natural home is death, we might say. And
yeah.
That's where the wicked here being those who are rejecting God, fighting against God.
Well, as it'll say here, all the nations that forget God, right?
Forget God.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one who doesn't forget the cry of the afflicted. is the one forgotten by all these nations.
Yeah.
And basically go home. They return to Sheol. It reminds me of the that C.S. Lewis line, the doors of hell are locked on the inside.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're home and they've locked the doors. But the needy, verse 18, shall not always be forgotten, and the hope of the poor shall not perish forever. Arise, O Lord, let not a man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. Put them in fear, O Lord. Let the nations know that they are but men.
Yeah.
And that the implication being they're not you. They're not God. They're not the Lord. You are. And remind them of that. And of course, remind us in order that we might humble ourselves before you and cry out to you and know that you don't forget the cry of the afflicted.
Yeah. I mean, so verse 18, you do have this, for the needy shall not always be forgotten. The hope of the poor shall not perish forever. That is to say that sometimes it will certainly feel as though the needy are forgotten, and that the hope of the poor does seem that it doesn't, that it has perished. But this is, in fact, not true. That it has, they're not going to be forgotten forever, and it hasn't perished forever. That these things, that God is going to do what he says he will do.
So, you know, we're recording these Psalm episodes at the same time we're recording the Job episodes.
Yeah.
So the, you know, if Job's three friends would have used a line like this, that would have been great. You know,
yeah.
Bildad drops, you know, Psalm 9:18 on the Job. That would have actually been a good three cheers for Bildad or Zophar,
yeah,
whoever. Yeah, hey, Job, just so you know, listen, the needy are not going to be forgotten forever. Won't always be forgotten, and the hope of the poor shall not perish forever. That would have been a good thing. They didn't say that, of course.
Yeah, because it's an acknowledgement that sometimes it feels that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, will God reject forever? That's what one of the other Psalms says.
Yeah.
Will he never be favorable again? Because it feels that way a lot of times. Like, oh, yeah, well, I'm needy here, but I don't see God doing anything. I'm poor, but I feel like I'm perishing. Nothing's happening. But it won't go on. It does happen. It will last for a while. But God is not the kind of God who's going to abandon you forever. He will come to your aid.
Yeah, he'll come to your aid on that day when he lets all the nations know that he's God and they're not.
Yeah, yeah.
All right,
well,
man.
That's it. Psalm 9.
Psalm 9. Well, all right. We'll be back next week with another psalm. Chad, I'll see you then.
See you then.